I would like to then call to order the House Special Committee on Telecommunications. First of all, by way of introduction, my name is Brian Porter, representing from Anchorage. I'm the chairman of the House Committee. Representative James from North Pole to my right, and Representative Ivan, appropriately for the topic of this subject, is on teleconference. Representative Ivan, are you still with us?
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning. Also a member of the committee, Representative Dyson, will be returning in the middle of the night tonight from a conference on another subject dear to his heart on child-related matters, and hopefully will be with us in the morning. The Senate has a subcommittee on the same topic that will be hopefully able to come in and out during the 2 days or day and a half of this committee meeting. Senator Parnell chairs that committee, Senator Donnelly, and Senator Adams from Kotzebue may or may not be able to participate during our time. Just a couple of housekeeping things. Would ask the presenters, there is an agenda on the back table indicating organizations that will be testifying. I guess just to make sure that everybody understands, this is an invitation-only committee hearing, so the general public will not be testifying, but we hope representatives from just about every affected industry, consumers, and service users will be testifying. The agenda, as I say, listing the organizations, and we believe the people, but if there is someone from an organization and the name is different, that's fine. We would ask those making presentations to sit where Mr. Ayers is sitting now so that we can hear that, and this room, notwithstanding the rubber attempts to enhance the acoustics, is very bad acoustically, so we will ask those presenting to try to be aware of that. The opening remarks that I would make are very brief. Basically, this committee was appointed because the federal government, in its infinite wisdom, has written a Telecommunications Act of 1966 that is intended, we're told, to bring competition to the marketplace and limit the amount of restrictions in the telecommunications area. The statute itself and the resulting regulations from FCC, which are, I guess, still being sorted out, have had indications of great effects on the states. And Alaska, while most states would like everybody to believe that they are different, we, of course, in Alaska know we are different and have unique situations that will be affected by this new statutory and regulatory structure. The considerations, then, that this committee will be looking at, quite frankly, will be first to try to gain an understanding of the industry, the past laws, structure, and what all the folks that will be talking to us have as an impression of what the results of the new statute and regulations are on Alaska. And obviously, is this going to bring a need in Alaska to change our statutory structure or regulatory structure? That's a very generalized position of where we're at, but the little that I know about telecommunications, and most of that's been gained in the last couple of months of preparing for this meeting, it is an arcane area that every time you ask a question, the answer brings two more questions, and I'm still at that position, and I hope, as a result of a day and a half, maybe we can start back towards the other way of having more knowledge and less questions. With that in mind, we had asked John Ayers to kind of set the stage and tell us where we're coming from and where we're at and give us some background. And with that in mind, I'll just turn it right over to Mr. Ayers. And if you would please, when you begin your presentations, announce your name so that we know that we've got the person that we think we have. so that Jennifer can make that on the record. And if you have any written materials, please give a copy to me, too. John, welcome.
Thank you, Chairman Porter. My name is John Ayers. I am the president of ENET Limited, a small but aggressive little consulting company here in Anchorage. And what I'm going to discuss with you all today is our view of what the Alaskan market looks like in terms of size and scope, some of the things we think that it needs to have to grow and to be healthy, and some influences that might be necessary to meet those needs. We went back and looked into some 1996 selected financial data and either used filed Form M's, commission reports, ATA documents, 10-Ks out of SEC filings, and some estimates of our own. The first two numbers that you'll see up there for revenue and income for local exchange carriers comes out of filings with the Public Utilities Commission. And as you can see, that's about $256 million with a net income of approximately $35 million. The inter-exchange carriers is a combination of Form M reports and 10-Ks, and that's substantially higher, as you can see, at almost $421 million. Although the net income was lower, suggesting that the level of competition in the inter-exchange market is somewhat more, perhaps, than in local exchange, as we would know anyway. Our estimate on that is our estimate on cable television. Our reading of the net income side of cable television is that it's not meaningful. It's either negative or not, or zero. From the standpoint of wireless services, which is predominantly cellular, that looks like it's a much healthier market. We think there's about 100,000 subscribers to cellular in the market with about $45 worth of contribution per month, and that gives us about $45 million in wireless services and $4 million in net income. Internet is still growing, but it's, as you can see, grown quite a bit in the past few years. We think it's up around $15 million. A lot of new entrants in the marketplace, so that'll be growing quite a bit more rapidly. And we have other revenues, which would be things like paging, SMR, and other types of telecommunication services, we believe is about $10 million. So a total marketplace for 1996, our estimate is about $822 million, with about $67 million in net income. We also looked at the access line distribution to kind of get an idea of what Alaska looks like. And you'll see up there that we do have a preponderance of exchanges in the smaller sizes. Looking at those below within 1 to 99 lines, you have 116. In fact, if you look at the note, the median size, that is half of the exchanges being smaller and half larger, for Alaska is 105 access lines. So when we talked about ourselves being somewhat of a unique market, I think that gives us one indication, as does the other end of the spectrum with one over 100,000. And again, the market distribution, you have six exchanges or six service areas that constitute about 63% of the marketplace. Indicating in the next slide the degree with which we've been successful in bringing inter-exchange competition to the marketplace, you'll see that there are 48.
There we go.
There are 48 locations representing about 336,000 access lines that are currently available to equal access. That is, if you pick your long-distance carrier and dial 1+, that's all you have to do, and your carrier is selected by the exchange itself. There are 22 who have been requested to and have plans for conversion in 1998, representing another 12,450 or so access lines. So at the end of 1998, we should see almost 94% of Alaska available to equal access. The question that we have to ask ourselves is, if the numbers I have are correct, of about $50,000 per conversion, is it going to be worth the $8 to $10 million to convert 24,000 access lines to equal access going forward? I think that the intent of the Act probably suggests that everywhere should have equal access. Again, I think we have to consider the economics.
For the record, excuse me, John, Representing Berkowitz has joined us. He's a member of the House Committee.
I apologize for my delay.
Okay. Thank you, John.
One other area we have some numbers on are cable television. We have 22 providers in the marketplace serving about 61 locations. far and away the dominant provider of cable television is GCI, with its recent acquisition serving about 101,000 subscribers for their documents. Our estimate is that's somewhere around 88% of the cable television market. I think it's important to note that in the lower 48, the direct broadcast satellite is a major competitor to cable. That's not so in Alaska. Currently, the satellites that serve direct broadcast don't have a good look angle on Alaska, so it takes a receiving antenna of somewhere on the order of 6 feet, depending on where you are, as opposed to the 18 inches that we see typically in the lower 48. That adds cost, it adds aesthetic issues for some communities, and so we don't see DBS, direct broadcast satellite, as being a major competitor to cable television in Alaska in the near term. It is possible that there may be DBS satellites launched which have a footprint that covers Alaska. I've heard discussions of it. I haven't seen definitive plans. There may be others here today that would have more information on that. Taking another look, however, you'll see that this infrastructure in cable television gives access to about 92% of the marketplace with coaxial cable access. So looking downstream at broadband distribution of data or other services, there's an infrastructure that exists, and here clearly GCI is advantaged by their acquisition. The service area in which their cable systems are operating cover about 82% of the access line. Again, our view is that there are some things that differ in the inter-exchange market, so in the local exchange market. So we'll talk first about what we believe should happen to have market health and growth in the inter-exchange market. The first and foremost is a fair and equal regulatory regime. We have some tariff approval barriers in place, which cause some competitive issues for everyone. We have a 30-day notice period on tariffs, and the tariffs require approval. They don't, as in the federal marketplace, require one day's notice and no approval. The net result of that, we believe, is price signaling, and it hurts competition. We think it should be approved. Certainly that's something that's covered in the statutes or the regulations, and that needs to be addressed in our opinion. We should have in the marketplace a one-day notice, as we do in the federal jurisdiction. That I think, would help move some competitive offerings a bit faster. It's a lot like sending your competitor a telegram saying, by the way, I'm going to do this offering in 30 days. Did you want to have a chance to do something to match before we get there? But a day later, perhaps. We also have some statutory requirements on the pricing structures that are antiquated that will need adjustment. Currently, the inter-exchange carriers are required to mirror the structure of the dominant carrier. We have rate bands. For example, in Alaska, one time we had, I think, 12 individual rate bands. They've been compressing over time. Each carrier who comes in has to mirror that. We don't believe that's necessarily in the best interest of the consumer, and certainly it doesn't make practical sense. We also see in this particular circumstance that the dominant carrier, currently Alaskan, is the benchmark. Not too long ago, there was a competing long-distance carrier who came to town and said he wanted to charge something on the order of $6 for an operator service call. The Public Utilities Commission said, oh, no, that's too high. Well, if it's too high, nobody will buy it. Why should we reject out of hand what one carrier believes he can sell a product for just based on a benchmark of someone else? We don't think that's practical. We think the marketplace would make a logical decision or a competitive decision. And if a carrier has a $1 or $2 operator service charge for a call and someone else has $6, you think the consumer will make a competitive decision on his own mind, what he wants to choose. So the whole pegging and relationship of everyone to one carrier's structure, we believe, has to be changed. Now, we need to reduce barriers for smaller companies. Right now, we have rules that are being applied to new entrants. I'll give you an example. Bristol Bay Long Distance, I think, has 5 employees. They're not allowed to use any of those employees on their long-distance venture that they've gone into. The anecdote that we get is we can't even use the same fax machine under the guidelines. Well, that's impractical, certainly. The argument is, well, Bristol Bay Long Distance has dominant market power for its 1,800 subscribers. Well, I'm not sure that was the intent of the act, and I think that has to be looked at rather hard. We need to have in the inter-exchange markets open access to the infrastructure, and we really need to encourage some entrepreneurial and market entry. And by that, we mean that the federal jurisdiction, the Act suggests that wholesale rates should be provided, and those wholesale rates should be pegged to retail. They should be retail less avoidable costs. That's not the case in Alaska today. For example, for all intents and purposes, GCI's wholesale rate is equal to its retail rate. Alaskom in the interstate market has no true wholesale tariff, although they're taking steps to resolve that issue. On the intrastate side, again, there is no general wholesale that is pegged to retail. So we have a tariff that AT&T Alaskom has, which is a carryover from a long time back. We really need to relook at the whole wholesale pricing structure, and that may have to be dealt with in statute or regulation. We don't see it being changed in the current activities within the commission for some time. We think we need to make sure that there is no domination of essential facilities. That is, no concentration of market power. There are some opportunities for that right now in the way that the licenses for wireless, cable television, long distance, and local service offerings are being prepared. It can create some more monolithic structures which would be barriers to the entry. So we have to make sure that we provide access to these on an open and equal footing for those competitors who are not going to be facilities-based. We also need then to encourage what we call niche market development or niche market development. I'll give you an example. We made for one of our clients an offering in a selected geographical area. The commission said, no, you got to give that to everybody statewide, or you're either doing retroactive rate making or you're discriminating against an Anchorage customer. Well, okay, so the idea is to see if you can respond to a marketplace where there is a small market opportunity. If every carrier has to compete on a statewide average basis like this, I think you're going to be discouraging the growth of the smaller, more agile carriers. That will have to be probably addressed either in statute or regulation. On the local exchange side, I think we need to understand, as Chairman Porter pointed out, the rules aren't yet set. That there are still changes being made, a lot of discussion going on, and yet I think we're subject to moving ourselves headlong into anticipating these regulations, probably at the penalty of the marketplace. So I think caution is required, but we do need to promote what we call rational competition. And that is competition that we say doesn't harm rate affordability, service quality, or reliability. We need to, back to one of my previous slides where I said we have 171 locations yet to be converted to equal access. Is that financially a good thing to do in the long run for the consumer? What are we doing to the costs downstream? We have a circumstance now, if we're building a lot of duplicate facilities in places in the rural areas where we have subscribers of the smallest served area has two subscribers. So, you know, the industry has done an extremely good job of serving Alaska in terms of its people. But we have to look at the cost. Is it more cost effective, for example, to suggest that all of the carriers in rural Alaska share one earth station and one technology so that the costs are distributed among them and thereby reducing the long-term price that has to be charged to a consumer? I think this has to be studied before we go pell-mell into duplicating facilities everywhere. The other risk to that, of course, is, and we'll get to that, is the second one down, but I'll come to that in a moment. That's the subsidy issue. We need to promote competitions that are consistent with rural exemptions. There were anticipated in the Act the need to provide some insulation in rural areas for the cost to the consumer, if you will, but more likely the cost to the individual provider. If we take a 50 subscriber local exchange, for example, should we require that exchange to unbundle its elements and allow co-location? I don't know at the moment. Intuitively, I would say no. There have to be other ways. There are four ways to allow competition. The individual company can construct its own facilities, another one. You can resell the retail, resell it wholesale, or the fourth alternative is the unbundling and co-location. It would be my contention that before we allow any more unbundling and co-location in the marketplace, other than what has happened in Anchorage, which is clearly a non-exemption area, that we think very, very carefully about how we proceed into that. Perhaps we should go in steps. We should go in with resale at one level or another, and then look at the economics. Certainly an economic argument must be made before we start doing a lot of unbundling and co-location in other areas. We're concerned that the competition is not for customers, it's for subsidies. The Act provides for multiple dominant carriers. It provides for multiple carriers of last resort. It provides for everyone access to universal service support and the high-cost fund. So the question has to be, are we competing for the customer or are we competing for the subsidy when we're looking at how we allow competition to unfold? I hear varying numbers, and the local exchange carriers here can talk more intelligently than I, but somewhere today there's $40 million or more in subsidy coming to Alaska in areas other than Anchorage and the general telephone areas. Everyone else is a taker of subsidy in the local exchange market. With that size of opportunity out there, one has to wonder what we're doing. Now, these are, in my mind, uneconomic incentives. If we're going out and competing for that, they're certainly not market incentives. I'm liable to create an opportunity here for debate with my local exchange carrier friends. I think that the subsidies are perverse and that they subsidize a provider and not a customer. So the choices the choice of competition is made by the provider and not the consumer. So long term, I think we have to think about how the subsidies are structured. I know that's an issue. I have a point to make on that in my final slide. We'll get to that in a moment. We need to ensure that there's a level playing field. My observation over the past couple of years has been that the commission tends to look at the playing field from the competitor standpoint, not the consumer. I think we need to start looking at what the implications of our decisions in the regulatory body and in the statutorial side of it on the consumer himself. In other words, if we do this, what's the impact on the consumer, short run and long run? Will the costs go down? Will they stay down to the consumer, or will they go up? Will more subsidy be required or less? Those are some of the issues I think we have to look at in making sure that the playing field is leveled. There are some areas where we can't wait for regulatory action to reach the goals. And again, we have to look into our statute and say, what do we have to change today that's inconsistent that can be changed without creating some other problems in the overall structure? We talked about the tariff issue. We talked about the wholesale issue with the timing, the 30-day notice and the wholesale issue. I think we have to look at what pricing flexibility our local exchange carriers have to respond to competitive entry. They have some of the similar issues to deal with as the inter-exchange carriers. We also have to look at speeding up the regulatory process a bit. I think that Steve Hamlin will tell you about a complaint he's had at the APUC now for going on 600 days. That's not the regulatory process. Part of that, we think, is that the resources are not available that the commission needs. The regulatory cost charge is paid the way that the commission functions and its costs are covered. It's passed on back to the consumer, of course. But nevertheless, if we're all willing to step up and say, let's give more resources to the commission to give us timely response, and thoughtful response, we also think perhaps that the commission needs to be divided between an advocacy group and an adjudicatory group. Right now we have cases where the staff is both the advocate and then participates in the support of the commission itself. We don't think that holds very well. We'd encourage you to look very seriously at the funding mechanism for the regulator, not forever, but certainly in the near term where all this action is going on, they need more resources. And I think that that can be covered under the regulatory cost charge. We need to make sure that there are safeguards in place against providers gaining undue market power. That is, we all have to have a fair share paid into the support mechanism. There are some structures that we can envision where the competing carriers are bypassing or will bypass, as they are in the lower 48, to avoid the payment of access charges. Well, this gives them undue power in the marketplace because the cost then of all the subsidy are passed to those paying who have a smaller market share from which to derive those payments. The last one, which may also get me some conversation with my local exchange carrier friends, is that I believe that the structure of the 96 Act will lead ultimately to the end of the subsidies. I think we're being driven by that process and by how it will be used and abused in terms of the subsidy issue. Who pays, when they pay, how they pay. Unless there's a lot of activity and a lot of research done quickly, then they have to end because they're going to be anti-competitive in and of themselves. They'll be pushing those costs onto a smaller and smaller set of the providers. Chairman, that's all I have to offer. But I will be happy to answer.
John, thank you very much.
Any questions, Mr. Members, or Dave Berkowitz?
Thank you very much. I apologize again for being late. Just very briefly, you proposing the removal of subsidies in cash-poor areas of the state, how would you expect people to purchase telephone services?
Well, my thought would be that if you want to bring competition to an area, you subsidize the buyer, and the buyer applies his funds appropriately. It's that, you know, if you subsidize the provider, I believe that's perverse. Again, this is my own view. Please don't extend this to anybody that I represent. I think that ultimately, if we're going to do that, it has to be that way. That consumer has to be given some set of funds that, or some subsidy mechanism. I won't say given the money necessarily. Applied to the consumer's choice, the end user's choice. I want this, and that's where I want my subsidized payment to go,
mm-hmm.
Not let somebody else pay the provider and say that here I am, I'm using the subsidy to provide you this service. Well, if I have choices, then I will make those choices based on my own ability to analyze the cost effectiveness of that decision. So if a third party comes in and says, I'd like to compete for your discretionary funds in this particular industry, and I can make my case, then that should be what allows me into the marketplace. It shouldn't be being subsidized to enter the marketplace to offer an alternative. That's my view.
One other question, then I'll let you have free reign here, which is your prerogative, of course. And I just want to be clear on this. You're suggesting that we need bigger APC, which is more government.
I'm suggesting at this time that more resources are needed at the Public Utilities Commission to do the work. They have some notices of inquiry to handle things like the market structure issue, access charges that they expect to take 12 to 18 months. If you want competition to unfold as envisioned in the Act, you can't take that much time. Now, you could say, here's some resources for 12 months or 24 months or something. I think that the structure of the commission itself needs to be looked at. I don't think, again, the staff as advocate and resource for the commission works in the competitive environment that's unfolding. So, yes, I think there are some two things. The structure needs to look at, and I think the structure will dictate that there's more resources required. How long that would last, I don't know. But I think it's a serious issue. I think it has to be addressed quickly. Thank you. Jim James.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On that same point of the commission, you talked in here about both statutory and regulatory changes. Can you think of any statutory change that would reduce the workload of the commission without interfering with fairness across and dealing with the issues that they have to deal with?
Do away with the 30-day waiting period and requirement for the PUC to approve a tariff. It should be allowed to go into effect on one day's notice as we have in the federal jurisdiction. Right now the staff takes the filings, we have a comment period, we generate a record, we get approval or not approval on a tariff. I think again the market forces have to be allowed more opportunity to decide which offerings it likes versus which it does not.
And if I might follow up on, I really support the issue of separating advocacy and the judiciary. In all areas, we ought to do that, and government doesn't do that very well at all. In fact, as one wonders if it's so close together, which one you're dealing with. What if we were to do that, what would you think? We would have to have one more person, or do you think we'd have to have a whole new set to be able to implement that sort of procedure?
Well, I don't know, but I would say at least that each commissioner would need a couple of people, one a paralegal or a lawyer or someone to do research and help to review and draft orders, and a clerical support person would be my thought. And then the advocacy group, I don't know. I mean, I don't know whether it's sized right or not now. I couldn't tell you that. But I know that, in my opinion, it's the direct support to the commissioners themselves that is the problem. They can't read everything they've got. They need to have someone doing some condensation for them into salient points and do analyses for them so that they can do the adjudicatory job. Now they have to do the reading, the evaluation, and the adjudication. It doesn't all get done. So I think that's probably where the resources should be applied in the near term, is to the commissioners themselves.
Follow up then. Would you see that because we suddenly have this whole issue on our plate, which is something we didn't have 5 years ago, that this is a one-time thing that we need to burst in and manage and get some long-term plans for it? Or if you think that the surge that we've had because of this telecommunications issue is going to be something that's going to continue to grow, and the needs of government oversight is going to be even more in the future?
Well, I think that the thrust is to provide for less requirement for government oversight and more from the marketplace. And so the analysis has to be more on the advocacy group. What's the level of advocacy required as opposed to the adjudicatory side? Both should come down over time, I think. The complaint mechanism probably will have to be beefed up a little bit, because now you're taking away a little bit of that, so perhaps the consumer side might have to be adjusted some. I would see that in the long run, the overall requirement for the telecommunications side should diminish. There are many who say that the 1996 Act is the death knell of the FCC, because it tends to push more and more into the marketplace. So I wouldn't say that we'd know long-term how long it would last. I think you have to look each year. I would suggest that, and I don't know the extent to which this exists today, but perhaps we could have a report card from the industry as to what its views are, and we could sit down and talk like this and say, what are your thoughts today about how the PUC is doing its job? I'm not advocating doing away with it, by the way. I think it has a requirement to exist right now.
Well, and on that point, if I might continue, Mr. Chairman, is that one of the reasons that we have a Public Utilities Commission in any area is it is assumed that utilities are a necessity of life, and there's a minimum amount of competition. That's the reason why that we have that kind of control over monopolies. If we don't have monopolies and we're going to encourage competition, then it appears to me that statement about getting rid of FCC is right on. It seems to me like if there's going to be multiple competition out there, that the competition should be able to take care of the issue.
Well, I think there's another side of it too, which, and I have to plead guilty to this. We use the process to help keep our competitors slowed down.
I understand that.
And we need to probably find a way to let the marketplace help us out of this. You know, that also, what you have is a regulatory process that in and of itself is a perverse situation from the competitor standpoint. I'm sure none of us still do that.
Just one more issue, and Representative Berkowitz brought it up, and it's a big concern to me, is that Alaska is a large, large state, and half of them are here in Anchorage, which doesn't, to me, pose a problem. I mean, they have the best of everything. They can have everything. They can have a lesser cost per capita, all of the things that you have when you have what most people in business call volume. But we have a lot of people who are very important to this state that live out in very sparsely located and very difficult to get to areas. And I'm concerned, particularly in the form of education, that we have what we need out there for them to get the same kind of education that they could get if they were in Anchorage. I use as an example, I live in North Pole and about 3 or 4 miles outside of my city, which is right in an urban, this is an urban area. We have a farming area, probably about 24 people out on this road, and they don't have a landline, and they can't even use a fax. And these are farm people who are in business just like anyone else and can't use a fax machine. And one of the reasons is the local supplier or the local carrier doesn't want to invest the money in putting a landline out there unless they are willing to pay for the line. And yet in some areas of the Bush community, they have Internet in their schools and in their areas. Now, the subsidy plays into that. That is one of the things I see if we were to continue to have any kind of governing body over how these services are provided, is to provide fairness and equality with all the residents of the state. Could you respond just a little bit to those ideas?
Well, I don't know the exact situation, but clearly if we can serve 2 in rural Alaska, we probably can serve 24 near North Pole. The question of cost, I can't address because I do know that that particular local exchange company is one who is subsidized through the high-cost support fund. So I think that's the question probably best posed to that particular individual. But at some point, you get to the cost-causer, cost-payer situation, too. We had some discussions at one time. I know Steve Hamlin was embroiled in this from United Utilities over should we spend $80,000 for a local loop? Fundamentally was the question. Does that make good business sense? No, not unless it's completely subsidized, but is that the right use of the subsidy? In some cases, it may be. Of course, at that time, we were on opposite sides of that discussion. But I don't have a good answer for you, except that one would think that in the urban area, as that would be, you still should be able to get service. The farm communities in the lower 48 certainly do to get that same kind of service.
I want to say I appreciate your presentation.
John, so that I am sure that I understand your comments about the APUC's role, could you give me a hypothetical case that you could track through APUC and show us where in one case they're an advocate and in the other case they're adjudicature?
Well, off the top of my head, we might be able to take, it's not exactly a clear case, but Alaska Network Systems was being brought into being, and Alaska Network Systems has in its structure like 13 or 14 local exchange companies who are the owners. The staff put together its recommendation for a non-interlocking board circumstance where the board of its owners couldn't be on the board of Alaska Network Systems. Then they gave the legal argument to the commission, and the commission, even though there might have been other circumstances, chose to accept that. So they're advocating that in the consumer protection side of it, but then they're also being the de facto adjudicatory agency. No one sat in between to analyze whether it made sense from the competitive marketplace. It was more of a bureaucratic decision that was perceived as a problem that we don't see as a problem. That's not a real good example, but it is an example. It might probably be a good question to ask some of the folks out here who have ongoing proceedings. I've been away from that for a couple of years.
Could you give us a summary of what you think that the new act brings to Alaska in terms of changes to the existing situation. I know that we had subsidies. I understand we're still going to have subsidies, but I know that ATU finds itself in a position of being the only local service company that is in one category. Everybody else is in another with different rules. Could you just kind of summarize that situation?
Well, I think it's beginning to define some rules on how competition would enter the local marketplace, largely driven, of course, by the RBOC versus the interchange carrier situation in Order 48. It talks about mechanisms for new entrants coming in terms of how to establish a wholesale retail rate structure relationship, which has largely been left to evolve rather than to have guidelines associated with it. It's given some ground rules for implementation, I think, that weren't there before. So it begins to bring a structure to how we open up the marketplace in the local exchange area. That probably is the biggest thing it does in my mind. It does provide for the universal service funds going on beyond, of course, for libraries, telecommunications agencies. There's one development which I'm not sure of. I understand that Chairman Hunt, in his departure, set up three Delaware corporations to do several other things as an offshoot of the Act in terms of how it relates to taking about $3 billion out of universal service funds for libraries, schools, and whatnot. So there's much that's not determined yet. So I guess I would say the biggest thing it does is it gives some impetus behind opening the marketplace. It gives us some ground rules for doing it. It gives us some essentially time frames to get it done by virtue of the government, Congress telling the FCC to get it done by such and such a date. There's still the positioning. There's still some things that have to be done. It'll redefine access charges to some degree and how they are achieved and how they're distributed. It's the high points to me. Each of us probably has different views.
I guess the last question that I would have, the statutory recommendations that you have made, would you think that we should do that before the final decisions, if you will, on the federal regulations are in, or should we wait?
I think certain of them you should do now. The Act is not what established the 24-hour notice period for tariffs, for example. Pricing flexibility in terms of how you structure it. Should we have rate bands or should we have postage stamp rates or should I have market-based rates is not necessarily something we have to wait for the Act either. So I think there are parts of the statutes that can be reviewed now, parts that have to be deferred. One thing I suggested to the Commission not long ago is that probably the fastest way to do it, albeit the bloodiest and most divisive, could be to have the elects, the IXCs, and the Commission sit down and rewrite the statute together, come out with a consensus, and then send it to you for approval. That would probably give a pretty good indication of what can be done now, what can be done later, whether or not that can be done quickly or not, and how much of a spirit of cooperation, because each of us has our own agendas in this whole issue. So, but if we could sit down and say these things are clearly wrong, for example, there's in the regulations it requires AT&T to have an answer time on its operators of 2.5 seconds on average. Why? Why is it in regulation? It shouldn't be. It's not required of any other operator service provider. So we are by putting things in writing that should be market-based, it hurts the competitor. It certainly doesn't do the last comment any good in AT&T. When I was there, I ignored it anyway, so why even have it? It didn't make the business sense, so we didn't do it. So what is those are things that they can be stricken now. They don't have to be continued. There are some that probably relate to how we're going to treat rural competition that may have to wait, but I think that there are some right now that can't be done without waiting for the Act.
Well, it's funny you should mention that. In my limited time in the legislature, I've noticed that there are two or three areas that just are extremely difficult to deal with. One of them, of course, is labor management issues. One of those is workers' comp. What has evolved is an ad hoc committee that has equal representation from labor and management that is recognized by the industries of the labor unions, respected, and asked to do just what you suggested might be done in the telecommunications industry, to develop proposed legislation so that the balance and the fairness and the lack of overdue special interest is already taken out by the time it gets to the legislature. The option, of course, is you can get to us first with some argument in an area that probably none of us is professionally equipped to deal with. So I guess I would ask John for a little more thought on that kind of a committee's development. And I would ask all the presenters that are going to come, if they would, to give us a knee-jerk opinion to whether that sounds like a viable concept or not.
Well, I think certainly it can be done. Because I find it always interesting that we all come to you with the same argument. This is in the spirit and interest of competition, and it's going to be good for the consumer. Well, everything can't be good for the consumer. It can be good for the competitor. And I think that's the issue that we've got to deal with. What is good for the consumer? What is good for competition? Competitors notwithstanding. And I think that you can take a selective group. It can't be a large group. It can't be one from every company. It could be a small committee of the Alaska Telephone Association on the local exchange side, it could, and then the inter-exchange carrier representatives and some public utilities, either staff or commissioner or somebody. I think you can do it with a group of people somewhere on the order of 6 to 8, which is, I wouldn't go much beyond that. I think there's enough common interest in the local exchange carriers to be able to put together a small group, a nucleus of people who can represent the interests of that group. I doubt that we can get the inter-exchange carriers to agree, but I think you certainly need at least a reseller and a facilities-based carrier to be representing on that kind of a group. Given the marketplace, I would suggest probably even that both inter-exchange facilities-based carriers be part of it. I do that reluctantly because let's find the things we can and move forward. And give them a time frame. Say, do it by this day. And the legislature, in absence of this document from you, we will do something on our own. With enlightenment.
John, thank you very much. Are there any more questions?
I just have a comment.
President James?
What a concept to do something based on reason instead of political will. what we're talking about here.
We haven't eliminated the politics.
John, thank you very much. We'll give Alascom a couple of minutes to come up and introduce themselves. In the meantime, I want to say for the record that the Alascom satellite launch poster has been in this room for a long time. It's not brought in by Jerry or anything. All right. We have representing AT&T, Jerry DeFrancisco. Jerry, welcome.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative James, Representative Berkowitz, Representative Ivan. Thank you. Good morning, and thanks for the opportunity to appear before you this morning. My name is Jerry DeFrancisco, and until 11 days ago, I was president of AT&T Alascom. And with me today is Mr. Buddy Riley, who will be succeeding me in that post, or actually did as of December 1st. And we came together on these comments, so this is kind of our position in total. I think what we're talking about this morning is an issue critical to the future of Alaska, just as it is to the rest of the United States and the world. I've been in the telecommunications industry for 25 years, and a little more than 3 years ago, I came to Alaska with AT&T in anticipation of the acquisition of Alaska. A great deal has happened in the industry and in Alaska since 1994, and I feel fortunate to have been a part of some of those changes. And this morning, I'd just like to share with you my perspective on what's changed, what hasn't changed, and what I think the implications might be for Alaska. Our state and our nation, and indeed the rest of the world, are going through profound changes. It's been called the information revolution. These changes are having the greatest impact on the way we live and work since the way we spend our time since Americans first left their farms 100 years ago to join another revolution, the Industrial Revolution. Some may argue that life on the farm was simpler, easier, safer, more predictable, and indeed the critics of those times had the same comments about that change as today's critics do about the information revolution. The Industrial Revolution brought us huge factories, mass production, and for the first time almost universal access to products and service. Moving from the industrial to the information age is really most pronounced in one area. I think power is shifting from those who produce to those who consume. The production advances of the Industrial Revolution put power in the hands of those who produce because they decided what was going to be made. We all remember the Henry Ford adage, you can have any color Model T you want as long as it's black, and a little more familiar, you can have any telephone you want as long as it's black. Consumer power comes from having many choices from many suppliers and access to virtually infinite information by many different means. And it's not about what producers want to send out, it's about what consumers have the power to go get. And that really is the essence of what the Internet brings to the information revolution, the ability for a consumer to have access to almost infinite information. Monopolies, particularly telecommunication monopolies, are a product of our industrial age. In order to achieve universal access to telecommunications, monopolies were allowed to exist as the most logical way to assure that everybody had a telephone. They worked reasonably well, efficiently, and they accomplished universal service. As was said earlier, regulation was necessary because without marketplace forces of competition, it served as a surrogate to prevent monopolies from abusing the privileged status that they had, that is, the franchise to serve and serve exclusively. I know that well because I spent half my career working for a monopoly, New York Telephone and the old AT&T. The other half of my career has been a very different one, working in a very competitive and dynamic industry. We made a lot of the same arguments then in the late early 1980s that are being made today against competition. We were not bad people. I think we were good people, but we were just wrong. Competition is not only the way of the future, it's the way of the present. Without it, consumers won't achieve the power that comes from choice and thereby reap the full benefits of the information revolution. The long-distance industry, I think, is a great case in point. Critics predicted that when long-distance competition came, it would not work. People outside of major metropolitan areas would see prices go up, and worse yet, be abandoned and simply drop off the network. The same dire predictions were made by the incumbent long-distance monopoly Alascom. In both cases, they were not only wrong, but the exact opposite happened. More people have access to service today than in 1984, both in Alaska and in the United States. And long-distance prices have fallen over 50% and are still dropping. In addition, consumers have myriad choices of plans, services, bundles of services that meet their needs. And the emphasis is on their needs because they're the ones that determine what is going to be consumed, not the producers. Technological change didn't just happen because our factories and our laboratories got smarter. It happened because consumers have an insatiable appetite for more ways to work and live better. Competitive companies in the long-distance industry are racing to stay ahead of consumers' wants and needs, and those who fail to do so are seeing their customers just go away. Like it or not, our lives are changing, and today's monopolies are telling you that consumers' lives will change for the worse, that they'll suffer, and prices will have to go up if competition is introduced in the local market. Well, that's just not so. It defies the laws of economics and free capitalism, and it also contradicts history. What will happen is that people in the monopolies' lives will change, just as my life changed drastically half of my career ago. They'll be fully into this industry and have to continually search for new and innovative ways to cut costs, do business more efficiently, and deliver services that customers want and need, and most of all, no longer have a guaranteed rate of return or profit. What could be more counter to economic forces in free markets than the concept of a guaranteed profit? That means a company starts with a guaranteed rate of profit, adds the cost in, and then declares a revenue requirement that makes the equation balance. In the case of the local exchange companies, this revenue requirement is rolled into access charges, which they charge to long-distance carriers and in turn ultimately are paid by consumers and businesses. Very few consumers even know that they're paying this as part of the long-distance service, much less what it's for. In this cost-plus world, what a company is paid for its services is a result of its mathematical computation. If a market offer is not successful or an investment turns out to be non-productive or wrong, the revenue requirement goes up next year, and the IXCs, the interchange carriers, and ultimately consumers end up paying more. In a competitive world, price is determined by the quality and value of what's sold. If an offer is not successful, revenue goes down. If an investment's not productive, the owners of the business hold the decision maker accountable, the investment usually is written off, and the firm realizes less profit. So in short, we talk about duplicate facilities, but in a competitive world, the business pays the price for that, not the consumer and not the customer. I think what happened in Alaskom is a good model for competition. Competition came late to Alaska because the incumbent monopoly Alaskom fought it, as AT&T did, and argued that Alaska was somehow different and that Alaska couldn't sustain more than one long-distance competitor. Alaska, and again, those were the same arguments made in 1984, and I believe, again, they were wrong. Alaskom had competition by the late 1980s, but they had something else that created a monopoly-like non-competitive environment. They had access to a subsidy from AT&T that guaranteed this rate of return or profit. So Alaskom started with a rate of return, added in their costs, and came up with a revenue requirement. With a competitor in the market, you couldn't raise rates without losing customers, so simply the check that AT&T wrote got bigger every year.
Yeah.
The answer to balancing the equation was this check, which was a form of subsidy, much like the actual subsidy of exchange companies today. By the early 1990s, this check was for over $110 million a year. And without this subsidy, losses would have been in the tens of millions of dollars. By 1994, that subsidy was equal to one-third of Alaskom's revenue. And that meant that one of every $3 of revenue that came in the door was not coming from customers, but was coming from AT&T. In fact, had no relationship to the company's business or employees. Alaskom argued vigorously against AT&T coming to Alaska as well. The word went out that no company could survive if a third of its revenue was wiped out, and no Alaskan LD company could operate without a subsidy. They predicted mass employee layoffs, deterioration of service, no network investments, retreat from the bush, and a withdrawal from community involvement. Well, they were wrong again. Just a little over 2 years later, the effect of the subsidy has been completely erased. The company's financial books are profitable for the first time in years. Minutes and revenue are growing, and costs are going down double digits every year. There have been no mass layoffs. Network investments have actually increased, and involvement of the community is stronger than ever. And we're in the midst of a massive program today to upgrade bush communications. By mid-1998, we expect about 80% of the AT&T Alaskom's traffic in the bush to be on the new platform. All this access to a subsidy. Well, what happened? Well, it wasn't brilliant management. It wasn't sudden robust market growth. And certainly there was no magic involved. It was the forces of competition at work, unconstrained for the first time in the Alaskan long distance. It was a concerted effort on the part of a lot of good people, the women and men of AT&T Alaskom, deciding they could not only survive without this subsidy, but they could prosper and win in the market. They focused on what the marketplace wanted and needed, and were fanatic about finding ways to cut costs and operate more efficiently. I'm intensely proud of these people because they did it the old-fashioned way. They just worked very hard and they earned it. They didn't ask for special favors, for consideration, for subsidies, or for time. They just sat down and figured out how to do it. I think there are many parallels with local exchange monopolies. They, too, will tell you that they can't live without their subsidy, the access rates, massive access payments that come from long-distance carriers. I believe that they can survive, and, in fact, I think they'll prevail, and I think in the end they'll be better off for having to live without those subsidies and finding other ways to operate. Access rates in Alaska are second highest in the nation behind Maine. And in Maine, the LEC networks are far more extensive than those in Alaska and cover far larger geographic areas, the local service areas. This hidden subsidy paid by Alaskan consumers and businesses represents 40 to 45 cents of every long-distance dollar and is by far the largest component of a long-distance call, and it's actually growing on the interstate level. It's nowhere near the true cost of providing the service either. Access reform underway nationally is addressing this situation and has in fact already resulted in price decreases to consumers in the neighborhood of over about $1.5 billion. It's essential that Alaska address this also. LECs are free to expend costs, and the long-distance carriers and ultimately consumers and businesses end up paying the price. It's artificially inflating the rates for long distance, and like Alaskom's former subsidy, bears no relation to the output of that company as a business. Currently, inter-exchange carriers pay as much as 85% of bush exchange costs, with no say or no control over what those costs are and how they're expended. This is just not sustainable and has to be changed. Just as Alaskom's $110 million subsidy was not sustainable, had to be changed, and I believe I can argue that it's to the benefit of all Alaskans that it was done that way. AT&T Alaskom is still committed to the push, as is demonstrated by our $35 million facility upgrade currently underway. Changing the access subsidy structure will in no way change that commitment. In fact, we believe a reduction of access to true cost of providing it will incent further investments of this type and challenge all competitors to find even more innovative and cost-efficient ways to deliver new and better services. Local exchange companies are an essential part of the telecom market and infrastructure in Alaska and everywhere in the country. It's certainly in all our best interest to see them succeed. We have no desire to drive them out of business or to see them fail. In fact, we would like to see them succeed. Where we disagree on how that success should be accomplished. Everyone in this industry, including current local exchange monopolies, must succeed as any other business does, by having the best set of offers and the best value in the market. And the sooner they dedicate themselves to doing this, I think the sooner true success will come. This means abandoning the historical cost accounting and regulatory artifacts that seek to perpetuate the status quo. Today's local exchange companies have a virtual monopoly on local exchange services and infrastructure. We don't believe that size really is an issue here if you do have a monopoly control over local exchange services and infrastructure. Critical end user information is inaccessible to competitive local exchange providers because there are no electronic interfaces currently available to provide that. There's alternative processes in place, but they rely on manual efforts, which are open to delay and obviously a lot of error. I think this is happening even where LECs are operating with good intentions. On any given day, we routinely have a back order of over 100 local service orders with ATU, despite the fact that we believe their intentions are only the best. They're really trying, but they're just unable to process the orders. Arguments by monopoly LECs for streamlined regulation and pricing freedom can't be accepted until viable competition with the appropriate electronic interfaces is present. Do so otherwise would slow down or virtually stop competition in the local exchange market. Streamlined inter-exchange carrier regulations in Alaska were not put into place when GCI initially entered the market, but only after they had acquired substantial market share. Therefore, any efforts to streamline regulation for local exchange companies would be premature until their market power has been substantially reduced. In the interstate market, AT&T Alaskom still carries the dominant carrier designation, despite the fact that with only about 65% of statewide share and about a little over 50% in Anchorage, we possess nowhere near the market power that an incumbent local exchange company possesses. When GCI first applied to enter the bush through construction of facilities, the old Alaskom opposed the effort. AT&T Alaskom, on the other hand, has fully supported this, despite the fact that our statewide share will undoubtedly be further reduced when competitive choices reach all rural Alaska. Advancing technology makes the economic viability of facility-based competition in the bush inevitable. It compels telecom providers to search for more innovative solutions to meet rural customers' needs while maintaining value for their shareholders. Despite this, some local exchange carriers continue to fight to preserve the status quo and in some cases oppose lifting facility restrictions in many bush communities. We do not oppose lifting this restriction because we believe we can be competitive with GCI based on our offer set and what customers will perceive as our value to them. We want to win based on our offers and our efforts, not based on regulation that prohibits GCI from competing. I'd also like to say a word about the replacement of the satellite capacity currently provided by Aurora 2. As AT&T, and indeed myself, has stated many times, we're committed to replacing this capacity by the end of Aurora 2's life, which we anticipate will be around 2001. This replacement will provide for all the existing service areas and has been well documented as part of our agreement to purchase Alascom, as well as my comments to the APUC in March of 1995. And let me add that we're surprised and somewhat irritated by the fact that various telecom interests in the state persist in rumor mongering and implying that AT&T will not uphold its responsibilities that it assumed with the purchase of Alascom. We've received numerous calls and comments from these interests implying that there was some kind of a secret plan under which Alaska would be allowed to go dark when Aurora 2's life ends. Those who were here when Aurora 2 ended its life tell me that no such concerns were voiced, so my question is, why now? This is particularly strange given our multi-million-dollar project to upgrade Bush Earth stations. This would be indeed an interesting strategy for AT&T, Alascom, to spend tens of millions of dollars in upgrading satellite Earth stations and then don't replace the satellite that they operate with. This simply makes no sense. Representatives of local exchange companies say they may require modifications to their facilities when the new satellite's launched. Well, I'm not an expert on satellite technology, but I fail to see why a satellite that interfaces with an Earth station should have any impact on local service equipment. On the other hand, I think we've demonstrated through our project replacing the Earth stations in the bush that we've cooperated with local exchange companies, and we've seen very little impact, to my knowledge, on service. We've worked very closely with them as we change that technology out. So why is this suddenly an issue? Well, I believe it's being raised by the same interests that have been raising other rumors and innuendos and outright falsehoods in the telecom area in Alaska. The root of these, I think, is a desire to somehow preserve the status quo and thereby the self-interest of the people who are making these arguments. These same interests have protested that we change our current wholesale tariff across Alaska. Well, the difficulty is that the cost structure that was in this wholesale tariff was designed in Alaska's monopoly days. It allows us to charge more for wholesale service in rural low-density areas than it does in the cities, despite the fact that our retail rates are the same across the state. Well, we're holding discussions with them on how we can devise a more attractive set of resale offers because they are a customer and we need to meet their needs. But at the same time, some of the local exchange companies who own these parties are protesting to hold on to their own high-cost designations and heavy subsidies in these same rural areas. There is a demand for more capacity on the North Pacific Cable, which I think you know has reached its maximum capacity. The irony is that AT&T Alascom has applied technology to increase capacity in the last 2 years, and we've sold almost 30% of that to other carriers. Where the irony comes in is that the old Alascom refused to compress service and thereby make more capacity available to competitors. But there is a limit to how much you can compress and how much you can restore if there is a damage to that cable. Let me provide, I think, what's another brief illustration. Recently, one of these parties representing the LEC long-distance efforts approached us about our receptivity to selling some or all of our Bush Earth stations to them. Well, I told them that we'd listen to a proposal, but unless there was some benefit to our customers and our company, I doubted there was any reason why we'd sell those Earth stations. That having been said, we made it clear that if the intent was to buy the air stations and then roll them the expense into the already bloated asset base upon which Alaskans pay the highest access rates in the nation, and then raise access rates, then there's no need to go any further. We were assured this was not the intent, but when the party returned, that's exactly what was proposed. When confronted with this, the reply is, well, why do you care? Most of the access expense is paid out of the lower 48. Well, we do indeed care, with 40 to 45 cents of every access dollar being paid by customers going right back to local exchange companies. I think we all need to care about this issue. The access subsidy issue cries out for reform, and we certainly don't need to make matters worse by selling our assets and then paying back many times over in access. The Earth stations would have been rolled into the asset base of the local exchange companies in question, and access charges would undoubtedly have been raised. Where do the access payments go? They go to the owners of the local exchange carriers. Competitive long-distance companies would be forced to either raise rates to consumers to compensate or eat the increased cost, while the so-called competitive long-distance company, owned by the LECs, would pay the same cost, but the cost would go right back into the pockets of the owners. This, to me, is far from an isolated instance. I think it's the crux of some of the arguments being made for status quo in Alaska. If we had more time, I certainly could provide more examples, but I think what I've given you so far is an illustration of what we believe is some of the things that are going on today. In terms of statutory and regulatory requirements, we believe that as long as monopolies exist, there's a need for regulatory oversight. That's why they were created in the first place. Our state regulators must address access reform and the changed nature of the Alaska market structure. I believe we have a framework for this in place with the Telecommunication Act of 1996 and a lot of current nationwide efforts going on in the federal arena and in many states. I think it's critical that the APUC get involved and make sure the same thing happens in Alaska. I do not believe there's any legislation involved at this time. I think the framework is there, and I think if we continue to move in that direction, I really don't see any need for additional legislation. What you can do is support the APUC in its efforts. I think we need to look at the resources they have, and this, if this is indeed a bubble, then how do we deal with that bubble of activity and clear some of the backlog so they can work with it quickly so Alaska doesn't get left behind. I think you would also urge you to be outspoken proponents of the competitive environment that's necessary to bring the full benefits of information age to your constituents. History has shown that they're going to benefit. And I'd like to commend the legislature, by the way, for its forbearance in refusing to accept many of the arguments and appeals to somehow change or redirect the intent of the Telecom Act of 1996. And I would urge you to be aware of those who expend huge amounts of lobbying, legal, and regulatory efforts in an effort to do so. Remember that every dollar or person hour expended in this way is a dollar not being spent in developing new and innovative services to be delivered to the left for customers. Well, in summary, number one, it's clear that open competition in all markets, particularly the local exchange market, is not only beneficial to Alaskans, but it's essential to ensure that we reap the benefits of the information age. Second, we believe that any effort to streamline regulations for local exchange monopolies will delay and, in fact, virtually stop the advance of competition in Alaska. We believe local exchange companies are a critical part of the telecom market in Alaska. And not only do we not wish to destroy them, we earnestly want them to succeed. But that success can't be won by the preservation of the archaic and bloated access subsidy system currently in effect. This has been recognized nationally and in many states, and hopefully Alaska is going to follow suit in addressing this situation. We believe what happened to Alaskom is an excellent model for the local exchange companies in Alaska. The dire predictions of mass layoffs, network deterioration, and service collapse just never happened. Just as the historical predictions of the impact of long-distance competition in the lower 48 never happened. The new hysteria now is about the impact of local competition will likewise prove unfounded. Indeed, we believe the market will be stronger as competitors continue to fight for customers' businesses. We also believe that lowering access costs will spur investment in new services and help attract and hold new businesses in Alaska, which is a critical need for all of us. The continual blitzkrieg of rhetoric and rumors and media hype must be taken for what it is. It's a desire to preserve the past. And in the end, I think it's going to slow Alaska's movement into the future. I ask your support in keeping the best interest of Alaska's consumers and businesses in the forefront and letting the Telecom Act fulfill its promise, let the free market work as it ultimately must. Delaying the implementation of competition, as I said, will only hold us back. It doesn't matter who owns the company, where its parents' headquarters are located, and what any of our predecessors did 95 or 75 or 15 years ago. It's all about what can be brought to the market today and in the future to fulfill customers' wants and needs so Alaskans can live and work better. Thank you for inviting me today and for your attention. I also wish to thank you for the acceptance you've showed me since my arrival in Alaska 3 years ago and your continuing interest in the critical area of telecom and information. I've truly enjoyed my time here and knowing and working with you. And I pledge to you that as I return to AT&T headquarters, I take not only many fond memories of Alaska and Alaskans, but a resolve to continue to be a tireless advocate for Alaska, both with AT&T and nationally. And I've committed that to my successor, Buddy Riley, as well. Thank you.
Gary, thank you very much.
Just I want to say sorry to see you go.
Thank you.
Wish you best of luck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I'm still on this APUC business because, and you've made some interesting comments about it, but I still see a need for them to be there, but I don't see it the same need at all that we have currently because of the monopoly and because of the protection of the utility that supposedly these people get. And I'll ask you the same question I did Mr. Ayers. is it appears to me, particularly in Alaska, where we are unique. You know, the way they do it in the lower 48 doesn't always work here. And that one of our most serious concerns is that the public is treated equally and fairly across the state and competitively to have the lowest prices. So it seems to me that the whole direction of a controlling government entity, if that's what you want to read, or not necessarily controlling, but oversight of government entity, would be to protect that interest and not be so specific to the companies and what they're doing. I just before I let you answer that question, I guess my biggest concern is that they don't interfere with competition. And currently, that's what they're doing because that's the design of their mission. So if you could respond to what you think might be a change in direction or a mission, a change in their mission.
I think the APUC is evolving in their role, but I don't know how anyone could have evolved fast enough to keep track and keep up with this industry. The industry is just moving ahead at incredible speed. So I think you're absolutely right. I think there probably always is a need for oversight to make sure that, I mean, there always may be a party that has the ability to dominate an area and stifle competition because of their position. So I think that's a role, an oversight role that can be played. In terms of filing of tariffs and prices and things like that, I think that should begin to go away as the monopolies go away. And I don't think it needs to be the same type of regulation at all. But it needs to be a different type of commission. And I think that as we look at where we are now, like with any business, there's a huge bubble of work that's appeared on the horizon for them. So the question is, number one, how do you deal with that? Do you increase your staff permanently? And probably not if you think it is just kind of a bubble that's coming at you. And secondly, what's the nature of that work? And the nature of that work is very different. It's implementing the Telecom Act. It's access reform. So I believe the APUC should look to say, what kind of help do we need in those specific areas to solve those problems and get things moving? And at the same time say, when that bubble is over, what does the world look like? What does the market look like? And what do we need then to do to operate in that market? And I believe it's very different. It's not reading tariffs coming back and forth and complaints coming back and forth. It's making sure the market is working properly and only intervening if someone does step in and do something, someone who has an advantage in an area, a monopoly advantage or a market power advantage, and correcting that.
The follow-up is having to do with this committee out there that might be able to help us to figure out what to do with this. It appears to me that some of our best intelligence is in those people who have been working on this APUC committee before, that they might, if their eyes are opened, be able, as opposed to closed, looking at where they're walking, that they might be able to see this different thing. The problem with having any kind of a government entity where we have statutory and regulatory restrictions on them, they're not free to make decisions in a boardroom like private industry is, and so therefore they're always behind the curve. On what we think, I think we need to get out is ahead of the curve. Do you believe that a committee from the industry could and effectively, with their competitive interests, give us a direction to go in that way?
I think it's possible, Representative James, but there are a lot of different interests out there, and I think the fundamental issue needs to be what's the mission of this committee. And I think if we pursued that, we'd find that perhaps the members of that committee have very different concepts of what that mission is. So it has all the potential of just winding out and being a very contentious and non-productive type of body. On the other hand, if we could agree on a mission in the beginning and get all our cards on the table, it's possible that it would work. And we certainly would be very open to participation in something like that. I'm just concerned that there are so many different interests and people looking to do different things that it's going to be difficult to get it working right, but that doesn't mean it won't work right.
Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
Jerry, thank you very much. We are very sorry to see you leaving. We're looking forward to working with Buddy, of course, but
your time here was a great benefit to the state. I would ask, though, that before you leave, and Buddy, if you could carry it back to us, I am interested in trying to test the water, so to speak, on the development of this kind of committee that to that end, if you could give it some thought, as, and I will be asking everyone that makes a presentation the same thing, on structure, mission, and any other comments that certainly would have on the idea. I would really look forward to getting your opinion.
We'll certainly do that, and I'll be happy to assist. But he's gotten on board very quickly, but any help I can add, we'll certainly do that.
So thank you very much.
Thank you.
We, I can't believe it. We are absolutely
we are so good.
yes, we're good. Well, we're small. we have scheduled a 15-minute break, and we're going to stick to it. And so we will go off the record for 15 minutes and come back looking forward to meeting with Mr. Dave Foskey, I believe, from Arctic Slope Telephone Association. We'll go off. The coffee perking is hopefully not going to come back and go ahead again.
None of this would be happening if this room wasn't full of telecommunications wizards. I started to say that in responding to the invitation of the committee, which we very much appreciate on behalf of the association and individually as a company, we determined that it wouldn't be helpful probably for everybody to repeat their particular story with a slightly different angle on it. And so I would like, with your consent, to focus on the particular issue of taking an overall look at the LEC industry in rural Alaska, the LEC operation, the Rural Telephone Exchange Company, upon which subsequent presenters hopefully can build on certain specific points. And so what I'd like to do for the next few minutes is perhaps show you things that you might already know, since all of you, and I think most people in the room, are pretty familiar with Alaska, but I would like to just get a good baseline going. By way of introduction, what I would like to emphasize is that the local exchange companies certainly are a subject of interest. The first two presenters have pointed that out. We are subject to a continuing and growing debate that will continue to grow and involve more and more sectors of the public and the legislature, the government, I'm sure. We think the public interest is best served when factual information underlies public policy. That certainly, I hope, is a truism, but we do feel that there has been some misinformation or disinformation or simple confusion, which has clouded this already complex debate about telephony in Alaska. And so what I would like to do is present, I hope, a brief and general factual overview of rural Alaska LEC operations. The main points I would like to share with you are: who are the LECs? Who do they serve? Where are we located? I would like to point out that we do have a look, and I have a short 5-minute video clip to put you right on the ground in one of the villages on a day-to-day local exchange operation. I'd like to raise the issue of what services can a rural Alaska LEC provide, and what are the limiting factors and perhaps erase a myth about that. And finally, to discuss briefly what is the telecommunication option for the local exchange customers in Alaska. First of all, who are the LECs? Depending on how you count, based on the fact that some of the LECs, such as PTI, are holding companies for three operations, like Telephone Utilities of Alaska, Telephone Utilities of the Northland, and Fairbanks. The companies themselves number 18. The operating companies are 22 or 23, depending on how you look at the corporate holding company arrangement. So they're spread, of course, all over the state, which I'll illustrate in a moment. They range in size from, as John Ayers pointed out, very small companies and very small exchanges, to some large companies, and, of course, the great watershed, perhaps, is the Anchorage Telephone Utility, a large municipal urban provider, and then we have some very small companies such as ours, North Slope, approximately 2,100 access lines serving an area of about 92,000 square miles. So there's a lot of variety, which you already, I'm sure, know. In addition, the LEC business consists of, and these are some numbers from the 96-97 reported figures, and they change rapidly. There are some growth areas in access lines, and I don't want to misrepresent that. Both the number of access lines and the overall inventory or value of this plant, this telephone local exchange plant in Alaska, is growing. And that was pointed out earlier. But about 370,000 or just under 400,000 access lines and a plant inventory of $790 million plus. And of course, when Anchorage is subtracted from that, there's a big chunk of that that goes away. But that's what the business looks like, basically, in the state. As far as where we're located, I'm sure this is very difficult to read on the projected screen, but we have provided some copies to the committee. And we also have a copy here. And based on the comment that was made to John Ayers earlier, we would happily assist in removing this and placing that in place, or not John, or Jerry DeFrancisco, excuse me. So that is available for that purpose or any purpose the committee chooses. What I'd like to do at this point is provide a little overview of a LEC in action. Is this visible to both the committee members and the audience?
I think you can turn it a little more.
We, despite the large monitors up here, it turns out that this is the working system, but it doesn't do color. And as a 21-year resident of Barrow, I can attest that right now black and white is perfectly appropriate. So we're going to see Jeff's day, and this is a overview of a work cycle for a rural local exchange company technician to give you a little better handle on what the day-to-day reality is.
And reasonable. For all of us to picture a local exchange telephone company office located conveniently in a community with customers, employees, and vendors coming and going during the business day. The telephone service personnel are dispatched to perform work orders utilizing service vehicles which are driven from the central office or service center and then from job to job in the local exchange service area. For a local exchange company with a remote rural serving area, such as Aztec, this conventional picture doesn't fit. The workday, which will last from 3 to 4 weeks, begins typically enough with the planning and dispatch meeting. The plant manager and Aztec's field technician, in this case Jeff Anderson, schedule the work which will be done for the next 3 weeks in the remote communities, not connected by roads, which Aztec serves. The technician then embarks with tools, parts, food, clothing, and survival gear on the first leg of his tour, an 800-mile commercial flight to Barrow,
North America's northernmost community and the first stop, as well as jumping-off point, to Aztec's rural local exchange service area villages. Aztec serves the northern Arctic slope region of Alaska. It is an area of 92,000 square miles, roughly the size of Minnesota and a chunk of Wisconsin, with no roads between any of the nine served communities. At Barrow, the equipment and baggage are transferred to a scheduled or chartered bush flight for the next leg of the service tour. A 100-mile flight brings Jeff to the village of Wainwright, where, starting at the modern Cold Digital Central Office, the rig begins. A field technician like Jeff, serving these small, remote communities, must have a broad array of skills. He is trained and responsible for maintenance and upgrades on a digital central office switch, for backup generator power and battery plant work, for computerized local customer and plant record management, and, more recently, for installation and technical support of telehealth and distance learning video equipment serving the village clinic or public school. Then there is the outside plant and customer premises work, using the best practical low-cost local transportation. Aztec's technician also performs aerial wire plant construction, maintenance, and customer service route installations, usually including both outside and inside wire work for Aztec's rural residents. Often this customer premises activity involves assisting the subscriber in understanding the increasing options and new technology-based services that are available. At this point in the service tour, Jeff moves into another role, that of marketing and planning new services for the residential, small business, and public agency customers of the village. After several days in the first village, the Aztec technician moves on to the next community, once again using local bush flights and carrying all the necessary equipment and personal gear with him. Arriving in the next local exchange location, the cycle begins over again. Jeff carries out the tasks necessary to sustaining and improving rural resident access to and use of the rapidly evolving public switch network, now popularized as the information superhighway. The service tour will continue through the remaining villages in just half of the remote Aztec service area and take up to 2 to 3 more weeks. In addition to the multiple skills just viewed, self-reliance is also necessary to contain costs. Cooking meals or occasionally sharing dinner with a local subscriber family are part of the tour. And finally, at the end of the day, settling down to sleep on a cot in the central office provides a well-earned rest before the Aztec service tour continues in the morning.
Hopefully that'll put an image in your mind of what's going on out there. And as I said earlier, I'm sure you're very familiar with a lot of life in lots of areas of Alaska, but I wanted to set a baseline for some of the other presentations today. Continuing, I'd like to just take a look at the business of providing telephone service in especially the rural communities. The old business consisted of a user at one end making a telephone call through an outside wire plant to a central office in a village, via satellite to another location, perhaps another village, and the scenario is reversed to another end user. And we tend to think of our rural Alaska network in that regard. The thing is, the rural caller has changed, and so the voice and fax slow speed facts dependency of the past is no longer adequate. Today's caller is trying to perhaps use telehealth for personal or community health reasons, video conferencing for distance education, data networking and data conferencing for business, perhaps applying to AHFC for a mortgage using email, surfing the net from 2 to 4 in the morning. So the caller is different. And as a consequence, the uses are no longer voice and fax. I won't repeat verbally all these. They're listed on the copies that you have. But certainly E911, telehealth, distance education,